Canadians are wondering what they did exactly to deserve steep tariffs on imports from their country into the U.S.
We've built the most successful economic, military, and security partnership the world has ever seen.
I'm Marco Werman. What's next for vital U.S. trade relationships with Canada, Mexico, and Europe? Also, how people on the Greek island of Santorini are responding to dozens of earthquakes over the weekend.
The only thing we can do, and this is to mitigate the consequences of a future event.
Plus, why tens of thousands of people in Germany are suddenly out protesting, and Indonesia has banned the sale of new iPhones, but that seems to have only made them more desirable.
There is a lot of crazy stuff that people do to get an iPhone here in Indonesia.
All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Carolyn Beeler is off today. Thank you for being here. Global stock markets tumbled this morning over what the Wall Street Journal's editorial board called the dumbest trade war ever, President Trump's plan to hit Canada and Mexico with 25% tariffs. The S&P 500, along with the NASDAQ, both regained some of their losses after the news that President Trump spoke by phone with Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum. The Trump administration said it agreed to put tariffs from Mexico on hold for a month while the two sides work on a deal around security and trade. The tariffs aimed at Canada are still slated to kick in at midnight. From Mexico City, the world's TV site Zaya reports on reaction from the United States' two biggest trading partners.
Mexico's President Claudia Sheinbaum arrived at her daily press conference with a big smile this morning.
¿Ya vieron el tweet, no?
Did you see the tweet? She asked a group of reporters. They applauded her. Sheinbaum was referring to a post sent by President Trump announcing the U.S. and Mexico had agreed to pause the anticipated tariffs for a month.
Tuvimos una conversación con el presidente Trump.
I had a conversation with President Trump this morning, Sheinbaum said, in which we talk about shared interests that we have.
Llegamos al acuerdo que está en el acuerdo que se puso de poder poner más guardias nacionales en la frontera.
Sheinbaum said her government agreed to send 10,000 Mexican soldiers to the border to help stop the flow of migrants and illegal drugs into the U.S. Trump said the two countries will continue negotiations this month. Trump's tariffs announcements on Saturday had sparked panic and condemnation from the U.S.'s top trading partners. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said the new measures would damage North America's economy and overturn decades of integration.
We've built the most successful economic, military, and security partnership the world has ever seen. A relationship that has been the envy of the world. The actions taken today by the White House split us apart.
He said Canada will retaliate with 25% tariffs on certain American goods, including honey, whiskey, and fruits. Trudeau also called on Canadians to buy local.
It might mean opting for Canadian rye over Kentucky bourbon, or foregoing Florida orange juice altogether.
Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum was also planning on taking retaliatory measures before reaching a deal with Trump this morning. Meanwhile, the Canadian government says the U.S. never told Canada what actions it must take at the northern border.
Less than 1% of fentanyl, less than 1% of illegal crossings into the United States come from Canada.
Retaliatory tariffs could hit certain sectors of the U.S. economy, especially in manufacturing-heavy states in the Midwest. Prices are likely to go up for gas, cars, and groceries in the U.S. But Mexico and Canada would be harder hit, as those countries' economies are much more dependent on trade. Both currencies from Canada and Mexico have already lost value against the dollar since the tariffs announcement. Cristian Ponce de León is an economist and expert on international relations at the Monterrey Technologic.
Entonces, en una subida de precios, que es lo que sucede con una tarifa arancelaria de manera inmediata, pues lo que decís es consumir un poquito menos.
He says if tariffs do happen, the demand for Mexican products would decrease as prices rise. This could force entire sectors to shrink in Mexico, causing job losses and inflation. And if tariffs were to remain in place for a long period, Mexico's economy could go into a recession, he says. The same could happen in Canada, according to the Bank of Canada. Xochitl Pimienta, a Mexican political scientist, says Trump is likely using tariffs as a negotiating tactic.
The
three countries will have to negotiate, she says, and once they do, Trump might rescind the tariffs as he has done in the past. Many are expecting that levies on Canada and China will also be subject to negotiation. Stock markets in the U.S. and around the world fell sharply this morning amid concerns of a trade war. For the world, I'm Tibi Saizea, Mexico City.
Ahead this hour, how Europe is dealing with similar threats from the Trump administration. In Berlin today, tens of thousands of people took to the streets. They were protesting the breach of a longstanding agreement in German politics to refrain from working with the country's far right. That political firewall is known as the Brandmauer. It was shattered last week with the passage of a resolution to curb immigration. To explain what happened and why some are calling this a shifting of tectonic plates in German politics, we reached out to Catherine Kluver-Ashbrook. She's the former director of the German Council on Foreign Relations. Earlier, I asked her about the original concept of that political firewall.
The idea was that both on the federal level, so in the individual German states, but certainly on the national level, there would be no collaboration with a party that had proto-fascist tendencies or leanings. And this has become more difficult in a parliamentary system as it is structured because they have indeed been gaining in power, both on the level of the Länder, so those are the individual states, but also in national politics. And right now, we have a German election coming up in 2.5 weeks. They're polling at 20%.
And has it been made clear by lawmakers that the AfD is one of those far-right parties that lawmakers should not be doing business with?
Yeah, there are a number of members of the AfD that are actually on the federal investigation list by effectively the German FBI for all sorts of ideas that are effectively reminiscent of Germany's erstwhile past from 33 to 45. And so the Democratic parties have reinforced this political norm, the Brandmauer, that there's no doing business with that party that, in fact, the Democratic Center has to hold. And as you noted, midweek last week, the CDU broke that in an election ploy to try to amp its own numbers, because, of course, we've seen many voters go from voting for a Christian conservative centrist party to taking a risk and voting for a more radical proto-fascist party.
Right. And so last week, that's why Christian Democratic Union leader Friedrich Merz, the lawmaker, relied on support from the AfD and passed this resolution.
It looks very much like it was an electoral ploy just ahead of the election. There's no real need at this moment in time to bring a parliamentary motion other than, and this would be Friedrich Merz's argument, to respond to a wave of mentally disturbed migrants attacking groups of civilians. There have been a number of, frankly, murders on German streets in Aschaffenburg and in Magdeburg and other places. And Friedrich Merz felt that it was an important signal to send even before an election, that he needed to send a signal to put a stop to this policy. But ultimately, it only passed with a majoritarian acting AfD, so with over 70 votes by that party. So the proto-fascist right-wing radical AfD is now in the center of German politics.
Kind of stunning. Catherine, according to polling, there was strong support for restricting immigration among the Social Democrats, the Greens, and the Liberals, parties on the left, which kind of seems surprising. Did Merz rely too heavily on polling?
Well, I think that was part of the ploy, that he would force the other centrist Democratic parties into signaling that they were willing and ready and able to make a change. But to play this card, if you will, just ahead of the election, with then what ends up being a cataclysmic result for the perception of German democracy, both inside the country, but also internationally, was an extremely risky play.
So, and this is all happening 3 weeks before national elections in Germany, as you said. What are the likely implications?
Well, the likely implications could be that Friedrich Merz, who is the head of the conservative centrist party, loses his potential, strong potential, to become the next chancellor of the Federal Republic, and that Olaf Scholz, who's the current incumbent, might in fact become, again, the leader of the country by default, because he said this himself, has just been waiting for Friedrich Merz to slip up.
So Olaf Scholz, the very unpopular leader, could end up just keeping his job.
Yes, indeed. And that will make German voters continuously unhappy. So the AfD will be looking to the 2029 election to finally make a play for governance, a very dangerous moment for Germany.
Catherine Kluver-Ashbrook is an advisor to the Bertelsmann Foundation, a German think tank. If you're superstitious, you might want to button up for the rest of what's predicted to be a long winter. That is if you trust Punxsutawney Phil, who saw his own shadow yesterday. You know Phil, America's favorite groundhog.
Get ready for 6 more weeks of winter this year!
Groundhog Day, February 2nd, has been around for 139 years and feels uniquely American. Pull on its roots hard enough, though, and they'll take you back to pre-Christian Europe. The World's Jerry Haddon has been looking at some other pagan rituals aimed at predicting the seasons.
In Germany, it's the badger. In England, land of hedges, the hedgehog. Early Europeans in America settled on the groundhog because that was the rodent on hand. But everywhere, the belief is the same. If the emerging animal is spooked by its own shadow and bolts back into its burrow, the cold will continue. If it doesn't, spring's around the corner. This belief is as old as a druid's wand. Anaïs Madera, an expert on paganism at the University of Barcelona, says almost all pre-Christian cultures in Europe had some ritual for trying to predict warmer weather. People's lives, she says, depended on it.
Estamos hablando de tradiciones que vienen de cultos paganos.
These traditions came originally from pagan cults formed by country people, she says, people who worked the land. They were deeply connected to nature's rhythms. They relied on this understanding to eat, she says, to eat and to cheer up.
Renace la tierra, pero también renaces tú, porque a lo mejor tienes mejor humor.
The earth is reborn in spring, says Madera, but so are we humans. Our mood improves. In pre-Christian times, Madera says, shaking the winter blues in Europe was surely harder. Before electricity and central heating, people spent a lot of time in winter splitting firewood and huddling in the dark. There were no sun lamps to combat what we now call SAD, or seasonal affective disorder. So, desperate for vitamin D, people pinned their hopes and harvests on the furry hibernators, though not always on the smallest ones. In Serbia, February 2nd is called Tretinja. It's a Catholic holiday commemorating Jesus meeting Simeon in the temple, but it's also the day that bears supposedly awaken from their winter slumbers. Like the groundhog, if a bear goes back into its burrow, winter's sticking around. Bears are a symbol of spring in many parts of Europe, but in Italy, predicting winter's end begins with a bird.
C'erano una volta merli bianchi e belli, sembravano neve tra i rami e gli alberelli.
The blackbird. It was once white, goes the folktale, as sung in this version online. But one cold January, during a blizzard, the bird sought refuge in a chimney. Later, it emerged forever blackened by soot. Somehow, that late January storm became a predictor of an early spring. Which might sound odd, but so is relying on the vagaries of a large rodent from the squirrel family. This year, for example, the groundhog known as Staten Island Chuck didn't see his shadow, suggesting spring is close. So who do you believe, Chuck or Phil back in Pennsylvania? Luckily today, we can just stock the fridge and turn up the heat. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon.
In Santorini, officials are putting emergency precautions in place after days of small earthquakes. We got the lowdown from a seismologist in Greece. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Today on the Greek island of Santorini, schools were closed because more than 200 earthquakes have shaken the area in the past 3 days. Earthquakes are nothing new to the tourist hotspot, but residents are taking precautions. Nikos Theodoulidis is a seismologist on the Greek mainland. He described to us how Greece is handling this seismic activity.
The only thing we can do, and this is our goal, also the goal of our institute now, is to mitigate the consequences of a future event everywhere in Greece, not only in Santorini. It's a twofold problem and two axes of solution. Both of them are preventive measures. First is seismic codes.
You're talking about building codes, yes?
Exactly, building codes, seismic building codes, to protect the buildings, and not only the buildings, the infrastructure, everything, the ports, the airports, everything. The most recent seismic code that is in force 20, 25 years ago, now our new buildings are well protected. The second and very important axis is the preparedness. For example, earthquake drills in schools, in hospitals, means informing population, means all population and all stakeholders to be aware of the phenomenon of earthquake so that they will be calm during the earthquake and they will perform all the measures to minimize or reduce the risk or loss of lives or injury.
We spoke about preparations for people and modern buildings, but there are major historic sites as well. How are they protected?
That's a good question. This is a big project on the protection of heritage. As far as I know, in Parthenon, which is our monument and our symbol of democracy and of ancient civilization, some measures were taken after the big earthquake of Athens in 1999. And you will laugh, but I have the feeling that the ancient Greeks, they knew very well how to protect the monuments and design them in a special way, engineering way, that they didn't collapse 2,500 years. During that period, many earthquakes occurred in Athens or around, but they had no problem because they behaved, their dynamic response was perfect. And we have a lot to learn from these monuments as well.
So, as you know, there are concerns that this current activity could be a prelude for a major earthquake, even a tsunami. I know seismologists are super cautious about making predictions, but what is your assessment of the situation?
To have a tsunami, we need, in the bottom of the sea, a displacement of 0.5 meter or 1 meter and greater. To have such a displacement in the bottom of the sea, we need a big event, an event greater than 6.5, say. If we have events with magnitude less than 6, there is no possibility to have a tsunami.
When you're in your office or walking through Thessaloniki, I mean, do you feel the earthquakes when they happen?
In fact, last month occurred an earthquake close to my city, and I was in my house, which is built on a rock side, which rock side means lower amplification of ground motion. And I felt it by listening the noise of the glasses and of the dishes. So, yes, I feel it. But if you walk in the road, no, it is difficult. It should be very, very strong to feel it.
Nikos Theodoulidis is a seismologist with the Institute of Engineering, Seismology, and Earthquake Engineering. He's on the Greek mainland assessing earthquake activity on the island of Santorini. Indonesia is in tense negotiations with tech giant Apple. The government is telling Apple, if you want to sell gadgets in our country, you have to build more factories here. Indonesia is actually the fourth biggest smartphone market on Earth, and officials are playing hardball by banning sales of the latest iPhone 16. As the world's Patrick Wynn reports, that's giving the device even more cachet.
Having an iPhone in Indonesia is chic. Some people will actually rent one before hitting the club, just to flaunt.
They just rent it for like a day to like come to the party. Okay.
That's Booty and his wife, Finny, from the YouTube channel Gadget Empire. They unbox and review phones for Indonesian viewers.
When people see that you are using iPhone, feels like you are cool. For now. Yeah.
But Booty and Finny have yet to unbox a brand new iPhone 16, the latest model. In fact, any Indonesian shop selling them one would be committing a crime.
For the iPhone 16, because it doesn't meet the regulation here, we cannot have it now.
Customs officials who catch iPhones illegally coming into Indonesia will destroy them, as they've demonstrated to local TV. That's an officer with a buzzsaw splitting an iPhone 16 Pro Max in half. The new iPhone isn't contraband per se. Possessing one, perhaps one rented for $12 a day, is still legal. So is flying to another country, like Singapore or Hong Kong or even the U.S., just to score one and bring it back. Booty knows people who've done this.
There is a lot of crazy stuff that people do to get an iPhone here in Indonesia.
If someone does bring an iPhone into the country, they have to register it for a hefty fee. Reselling one for profit could bring up to a year in prison. What did Apple do to upset Indonesia's government this bad? It's more about what it didn't do.
Indonesia has big ambitions for its future. They aim to become a developed country by 2045.
Hilman Palau is an Indonesian policy analyst with the Lowy Institute. He says, to become a developed country, Indonesia needs a boost from foreign corporations. So it's insisting that for any smartphone sold in the country, 40% of its components must be made in Indonesia. Apple has not met the mark, and officials are not budging.
Clearly, Indonesia would like to send a message. Access to its market comes with expectation of contributing to its goal.
And what a market Indonesia has. A young population with more than 200 million smartphone users. Only China, India, and the U.S. have more. Indonesia is a gold mine for any tech company. And those who bend to its rules do get rewarded.
Look at the Chinese. Market leader in Indonesia is Chinese brands.
He's talking about Xiaomi, the top-selling phone brand in the country. Every phone this Chinese firm sells in Indonesia is mostly assembled by Indonesian factory workers. Watching Xiaomi devour more market share month after month is a disaster for Apple. But Budi, of the husband-wife tech reviewing team, says as soon as Apple can sell its new iPhones in Indonesia, they'll fly off the shelf.
A lot of people here in Indonesia also waiting for the new iPhone. I believe Apple won't stay silent about it.
Apple did once meet the government's Made in Indonesia ultimatum, enough to sell its last model, the iPhone 15, in 2023 for about $900. The requirements have gotten stricter since then, and Apple hasn't kept up. Finny, Budi's wife, uses an iPhone 15 and loves it. She says Indonesia does have its own smartphone brands too, but they're often seen as low-grade iPhone imitations, selling for under $100. Speaking Indonesian, Finny says it would be nice to see a homegrown brand compete with the Apples and Samsungs and Xiaomis, but they're not there yet. As for the iPhone ban, Apple has been fairly tight-lipped, but in several statements has said it is trying to comply. Without giving away many details, Indonesian officials say Apple is very close to meeting their demands. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
We will be right back with more. You're listening to The World. The global economy is not really new. Its origins go back centuries, when traders traveled the world in search of things like spices. Conquest in the name of making people's food less boring.
Just picture yourself in a world where you didn't have those spices. Certainly judged by today's tastes, that would seem very bland indeed.
That's still ahead here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Earlier this hour, we reported on the rift President Trump has caused with Canada and Mexico by calling for tariffs on those close neighbors. American allies and trading partners in Europe are also worried about being pulled into a trade war. Trump added to those fears last night when he said new tariffs on the European Union would, quote, definitely happen. U.S. relations with the EU are already under strain after Trump threatened to take control of Greenland, an autonomous territory under Denmark's authority. The Danish prime minister said that's not going to happen. But the response from other EU leaders to threats from the Trump administration has been relatively muted. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry looked into why.
Standing on the tarmac next to Air Force One last night, President Trump didn't hold back when asked whether he plans to impose tariffs on the EU.
Because they've really taken advantage of us. And they don't take our cars, they don't take our farm products, they take almost nothing. And we take everything from them. It's an atrocity.
The US is the European Union's biggest trading partner as of 2023. But Arantxa Gonzalez, a former executive director of the International Trade Center, says Trump is wrong to say it's all a one-way street.
The EU exports more goods to the US than the US does to Europe, and the US exports more services to Europe. It's a vibrant economic relationship that both sides benefit from.
Trump's comments sent the stock markets in Europe tumbling this morning. Still, the EU's top diplomat, Kaja Kallas, was cautious in her reaction to the threats.
We were listening carefully to those words, and of course, we are preparing also on our side. But we are very interlinked. We need America, and America needs us.
Stay calm and exercise restraint. That's the advice of Arantxa Gonzalez, and she has some experience. Gonzalez was Spain's foreign minister during Trump's first term.
You try to be understanding. So first you try to do persuasion, right? But if it doesn't work, if there is a measure imposed unilaterally on the European Union, then you have to go through retaliation, understanding that an eye for an eye and we will all be blind.
But some in Europe wonder if this soft approach really works. When Trump first talked about taking control of Greenland, the Danish Prime Minister was quick to dismiss his remarks. Other EU leaders said little at all. Then Trump raised the possibility of using military force. Still, some in the EU played it down.
Grenzen dürfen nicht mit Gewalt verschoben werden.
German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said borders must not be moved by force. He didn't mention Trump by name, though, as he spoke to the press last week with the Danish Prime Minister at his side. Jakob Kierkegaard with the Bruegel Centre, a Brussels-based think tank, says there's a good reason many EU leaders are staying quiet.
Obviously, all of the EU has bigger fish to fry. First and foremost, of course, Ukraine and the strategic interest that the EU has in continuing or helping facilitate the continuation of US military support for Ukraine.
There was lots of talk about Trump-proofing Europe in the lead-up to January's inauguration, but nobody was thinking about Trump possibly invading a part of EU territory, Kierkegaard says. Weeks before Trump threatened all of Europe, he singled out Denmark, saying it would face US tariffs if it refused to sell Greenland.
And I also don't think that the EU would necessarily have prepared itself for a scenario where the country singled out for, quote unquote, this potential trade war would be Denmark, which is arguably one of the most pro-American members of the EU.
Some political experts say there's another factor at play that's weakening EU solidarity right now.
There are several European countries led by right-wing populist leaders who are kind of ideologically close to Trump and have been really happy about Trump's victory.
Kristi Raik is director of the International Centre for Defence and Security in Estonia. She says the leaders of Hungary, Italy and Slovakia all see Trump as an ally on ideological grounds, not just as a trade partner. And they're not about to go to bat for Denmark. Still, Reich says, the bloc needs to stand up to Trump. Strength is something he respects, she says. The EU needs to show it can be tough too. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Abandoned at sea does not necessarily involve a shipwreck. A growing number of vessels and their crews have been left adrift, essentially for bureaucratic reasons. Cases have doubled in the past 3 years, according to an analysis from the United Nations. Helen Wiefering has been reporting on this for the Associated Press.
Cases really first spiked during the global pandemic, and they've kept rising as we've seen these inflationary pressures on the shipping industry, especially around fuel costs. Last year, we saw more than 230 ships were reported as abandoned. And that was impacting about 3,000 seafarers, which is a significant increase over the past years.
Yeah, so it sounds like economics are the primary cause, but why would ships and their owners just be abandoned, especially when they've got crew on board?
You know, there are certain costs associated with shipping that our ship owners really can't pinch on. You need fuel to get from point A to point B. And sometimes these less reputable companies see labor as a place where they can cut back. So they'll stop paying their crews for a couple of months, oftentimes promising to pay when things turn around. But, you know, we see that oftentimes that never happens. And these ships can be stranded in ports with workers on board, and comes to local advocates and volunteers to really ensure their welfare.
So what is the extent of this problem? Like, how many ships and how many personnel are we talking about?
Yeah, we're talking about thousands of workers on a couple hundred ships. Last year, 230 ships were reported as abandoned. But obviously, you know, the only cases that come to light are the ones where workers are willing to complain and, you know, kind of risk their position and submit a complaint to their union representative or their authorities. So it's really unknown how bad it could be worldwide, but it is definitely affecting thousands of workers and has been continually getting worse.
So do we know what kind of pressure it takes to get a ship that's been like abandoned to get moving again, or any of the crew members, if they get off the ship, who's lobbying on their behalf?
There are a number of advocacy groups who are plugged into this issue. One of the biggest ones is called the International Transport Workers Federation, and they are kind of a group of maritime unions who have inspectors all over the world who visit these ships when possible. And if they hear that, you know, situations on board have become inhumane, they'll mobilize to get resources and really fight for those workers' wages on their behalf. But that said, they can only do so much, especially, you know, with limited funding. It really tends to be the flag registries, which register these ships on their rosters, that are technically responsible for ensuring that the ships they register will pay their workers and provide safe and clean living conditions, which are kind of dropping the ball. And the United Nations can put pressure on those flag registries to say, get in touch with this ship, make sure these workers are paid and sent home. But that can take weeks or months and sometimes over a year.
So you mentioned, Helen, earlier that the problem is getting worse. But, I mean, as you said, it all set in during the pandemic. Business has picked up again. So why does it continue to get worse?
People don't have a, you know, an obvious, clear answer on such a global phenomenon. But one other reason that might be contributing is that workers might be more willing to report this kind of abuse. Groups like the International Transport Workers Federation have really tried to raise awareness about this phenomenon and make sure seafarers and workers know about their rights. So that's one other explanation, but we're talking about this slice of the industry that is very subject to small increases in prices.
So it was the UN International Labor Organization that published this report on the number and increase of abandoned ships. Does the UN have a recommendation for preventing more ships and crews from being thrown into this limbo?
Yeah, the UN, I think, and the advocates involved want to see more countries sign on to this international treaty called the Maritime Labor Convention. That convention was drawn up in 2006. Close to 100 countries have ratified it, but there's still a number of countries that haven't, and that creates loopholes where ship owners can more easily abandon their ships. For instance, last year, the top countries for cases were Saudi Arabia, Egypt, United Arab Emirates, and Turkey, and currently the Maritime Labor Convention is not in effect in any of those countries. So the people who are really closely involved on these cases tell me, you know, ship owners look to those countries that haven't ensured those rights as, you know, places where they can dump their crews and their ships. So the UN and I think many people hoping to see this issue go away want to see, you know, really unified agreement and ratification of the Maritime Labor Convention.
Helen Wiefering is a reporter with the Associated Press on its global investigations team. She joined us today from Washington. There's an effort in some major cities around the globe to be more bicycle friendly. In Paris, more people are using bikes and cars. The city of Los Angeles is promising to drastically increase the number of bike lanes ahead of the 2028 Olympics. But in Toronto, things are moving in a different direction. Officials there are pushing to remove bike lanes. The Royal's transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel has more on the battle over bikes in Canada's biggest city.
For the past few years, Toronto has been transforming into a certifiably cyclist-friendly city, putting in place miles of new protected bike lanes, first to temporarily help with social distancing during the pandemic, then, due to popularity, they were made permanent. But not everyone was on board.
We all woke up and, hello, here's a bike lane that no one uses.
Late last year, Ontario Premier Doug Ford introduced legislation to dismantle bike lanes on major roads, citing in a press conference reports that Toronto streets are the most congested in North America and third most globally.
They're backed up from here to Timbuktu and the cars. People do not want the bike lanes.
The backlash to Ford's plan, which was signed into law in November, has been swift.
There are real repercussions to this removal of bike lanes. People will get hurt and people will die.
Marie LeBlanc Flanagan is a longtime cyclist and a video game designer. After Bill 212 passed, she decided to work on a sort of digital protest, a game about how difficult it is to bike in Toronto without protected lanes.
It had been a seed in my mind for many years since I moved to Toronto many years ago. I noticed how difficult it is to ride in this space that I call the loser lane.
The loser lane, which is what she named the game, is the space where bikers are forced to confront delivery trucks, parking cars, and opening doors when there aren't protected bike lanes. In her creation, you use the arrow keys on your computer to avoid getting hit. The catch is, it's unwinnable. You always die. A grim joke that Flanagan says she's surprised went viral.
When I released the game, I thought that my friends would laugh and my mom would be worried. That was the response I expected. And I just got an enormous response.
An enormous response because to cyclists around Toronto, the threat of death isn't just a game. It's daily life. Despite the addition of protected lanes, 2024 was the deadliest year on record for cyclists in the city.
My name is Michael Longfield. I'm the executive director of Cycle Toronto.
Michael Longfield heads up a biking advocacy group that's filed an injunction aimed at blocking the provincial government from tearing up the city's bike lanes. He was hospitalized with a broken femur in December after being hit by a door in an unprotected lane.
In this case, I was actually on my way to the hospital for a different checkup, funnily enough. So instead of going to the hospital for my checkup, I ended up in the hospital in the emergency room. So I'm still recovering at home, recovering from surgery. It's been 7 weeks, still on crutches.
To experts, Longfield's accident is among troves that prove protected bike lanes are necessary for the safety of cyclists.
If we look at the data on injuries and fatal collisions on urban streets, including streets in Toronto, many of them you will see that happen in areas where bicyclists were not physically protected.
Rokhti Mitra is a professor at Toronto Metropolitan University, where he studies the use of bike lanes around the world. He says not only would removing the lanes be harmful to cyclists, but also, in the long term, it could actually hurt efforts to reduce traffic.
If more and more people are switching from driving to bicycling, then we don't need as much space for driving.
While the numbers are still relatively small now, Mitra and other experts say more bike lanes, not fewer, would help ease congestion in the future. A recent study he conducted found that cyclists were more than twice as likely to bike nearly every day for commuting after the addition of bike lanes. Even still, Premier Ford and his allies are moving forward with their proposal. Ford himself declined an interview for this story. And defending the bike lane removal, Ontario's Minister of Transportation says in a statement, quote, "We need to deliver on our plan to keep people moving by bringing sanity back to bike lanes." For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
The 67th annual Grammy Awards were held last night. We spent last week introducing you to the artist nominated in the Best Global Music Album category. The Academy voted, and the winner is Matt B. His album, Al Kebulan 2, was recorded in collaboration with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in London. This is Matt B's first ever Grammy. In his acceptance speech, he spoke to what inspired him and his album's mission statement.
And to think that this journey started all from an ancestry DNA test, and I found out that I was mostly Nigerian. I hope that this work helps to bridge the gap between Africa and America, between Africans and African Americans.
Also nominated in that category was Nigerian artist Tems. She may not have won Best Global Music Album, but she did take home the prize for Best African Music Performance with her song Love Me Jeje. Hey,
I'm on your vibe now. You got me on your side now. Yeah, I'm on your wave right now. Whoa, 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 yeah. If not you,
this is Tems' first Grammy as a solo artist and her second overall. On our global music radar, there were a few winners who are seasoned at this awards game. Taking home her fourth Grammy win last night, Colombian pop superstar Shakira. Her album Las Mujeres, Ya No Lloran, won the award in the Best Latin Pop Album category. Also no stranger to the Grammy stage, Venezuelan conductor Gustavo Dudamel, in collaboration with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, they won a Grammy for Best Orchestral Performance. Their album includes several pieces from the Mexican composer Gabriela Ortiz. Up next, spices infuse food with flavor and aroma and turn a blah dish into something memorable. But the history of how spices made their way around the world, that is complicated. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In my kitchen, there's a drawer with all our spices. They're arranged alphabetically, cinnamon, clove, curry. Jump down to the ends, and there's nutmeg. Now, that nutmeg, it most likely comes from the Banda Islands in Indonesia. The story behind nutmeg, a lot of other spices, in fact, is the subject of a new book by Nicholas Nugent called The Spice Ports, Mapping the Origins of Global Sea Trade. When I spoke with Nugent recently, I asked him to tell me more about how that nutmeg got to my kitchen.
The story of nutmeg is that originally it only had one source, and that's in the fabled Spice Islands of what is now Indonesia. And just a small number of islands, as you say, in the Banda Sea, so the Banda Isles, was the original home of nutmeg. Now, when I say original home, that meant in the 16th, 17th century, it didn't grow anywhere else in the world. And of course, nowadays, it comes from a lot of other places, perhaps the Caribbean, an island like Grenada. But as I say, I started off at the beginning when you had to go halfway around the world to find any nutmeg.
So I want to get into how all these explorers were actually sponsored to get these spices. But before that, like, give us a sense of what the average pantry looked like for people in Europe before all these spices came on the scene. Like, what did all this do to people's taste? Because it must have been pretty bland.
Well, that's my understanding. I mean, I'm no cook, but if you just, as you say, think how important spices are to our diet today, or our culinary experience, I should say. We love to spice our food up. We put all sorts of spices, and a good kitchen has all those spices on display for use as necessary. So just picture yourself in a world where you didn't have those spices and you didn't have elaborate recipes. You had rather basic foodstuffs. So certainly judged by today's tastes, that would seem very bland indeed.
I mean, it's a fascinating book you've written, The Spice Ports. It's nominally about spices, but the subtext is really colonialism and these early salvos of globalization. The Banda Islands, which you're talking about, they're part of what used to be known as the Spice Islands, as you said. Today, we call them the Moluccas. They're in Southeast Asia, and the spices in this region really inspired a much bigger concept of global trade. Explain that.
Yes, well, if you think in the days we're talking about, 16th, 17th century, food was perhaps rather bland. Drink was even worse. So that's why spices took off. As you quite rightly say, it was the beginning of colonialism, because the European nations, starting with Venice, part of Italy, and then carrying on with Portugal and the Dutch and the English, all rivaled each other to gather this spice.
So the mariners, the explorers who traveled the globe looking for these spices, they needed support from their kingdoms. And two of the biggest sponsors were women, Queen Isabella of Spain and Queen Elizabeth I of England. Who were their biggest beneficiaries?
Well, yeah, I think you can't ignore the fact that even the monarchs were making a bit of money, making a bit of profit on this. So they might sound like it was a magnanimous gesture for their peoples, but I don't think the monarchies of Europe were quite that sophisticated. And I think certainly Queen Elizabeth, she made money out of the spice trade, which she then reinvested in the English East India Company, which was founded during her reign.
I mean, Nicholas, we have to remember as well that we're talking the brutal edge of colonialism here, a horrific period of history whereby mass production was being attempted by enslaving people who had no choice in the matter. They were abducted en masse and taken away and used for slave labor. Indigenous people were massacred. The Dutch conquest of the Banda Islands is just one example of this brutality, instigated by a Dutch explorer named Jan Pieterszoon Koen. What did he exactly do?
As you say, he massacred the inhabitants. He and fellow Dutchmen massacred the inhabitants of the Banda Isles simply because he wanted to put in his own farmers, effectively, to run the estates.
I'm just curious if you know how the people of Banda, of Indonesia, reflect on this whole period. Like, do spices like nutmeg carry some odd stigma?
There's quite, especially in Banda, there's quite a good spirit around because the islands are quite famous even within Indonesia because of their distinctiveness, because of their relationship to nutmeg and mace, and indeed the colonial past.
Are you saying there is a soft spot for the colonizers?
I think yes, but don't get that out of perspective. You know, it's not my role in writing this book either to support or to challenge colonization. It is my role to try to describe the past as accurately as I can and to understand these contrary attitudes, let's put it like that. I mean, India and Indonesia, the two countries we're mainly talking about here, are both very prosperous nations these days. And it is arguable that a lot of that prosperity should be credited to those who ruled the countries over centuries.
Yeah, with the understanding that that rule also had some terrible consequences.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It was interesting when you said earlier, I'm no cook. I'm just curious how you kind of got interested in spices and the history with no real enthusiasm for the kitchen.
My interest is mainly geographical and historical. And it was spices that enabled me to tell the geographical and historical story I wanted to tell.
So, Nicholas, aside from the flavor these spices add to our food, what other benefits were made from the early days of the spice trade?
Indeed. Well, I think there were three things that the spice trade drove, which helped the countries find the spices. The obvious one was boat building, ship building. Then number two, I would say, is the technology of sailing, notably the telescope, for example, which was invented in the Netherlands but became popular in Venice, thanks to Galileo. And the third thing of which I'm particularly keen are the maps. The creation of maps and indeed the updating of maps, these three things are very important. But we could add the theory of economics, the importance of, to use modern terminology, the monopoly control, the supply chain. These are everyday expressions these days, but it was early trading and especially early maritime trading that gave rise to these concepts, profit and loss, supply and demand.
Mm, all in the service of making European food taste more interesting.
Absolutely.
Nicholas Nugent, thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you, Marco.
Nicholas Nugent's new book is The Spice Ports, Mapping the Origins of Global Sea Trade. He's a former journalist with the BBC World Service. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. As always, thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Mary Elizabeth Alexander, Sarah and Stephen Bass, Stephanie Fox and Drew Britcher, Deet and Paul Meserve, and Corey Zanin. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.